Good afternoon, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another episode. Today, we are recording episode number 116, a small channel that started in 2023. Maintain continuous recording, continuous episodes being launched and published to the audience on a weekly and sometimes semi-weekly basis. Which seems to be getting a lot of feedback, a lot of positive feedback from our audience. Today, I have the honor and the distinct pleasure to be joined by Philip Swan. And Philip works for Iridius. Philip is the co-founder and a chief product manager and the go-to-market person for Iridius. We're going to get to know Philip on a personal level today, and also would like to get to know Iridius. What do they do? What kind of product they do? What problem do they solve? And hopefully give Philip and Iridius a little bit of visibility to the Localization Fireside Chat community. And from there, hopefully that is all positive for the audience and for Philip and his team. Philip, welcome to the channel. Glad to have you with me. The floor is yours. If you don't mind introducing yourself, I tell everybody's got a story. What's the story on your side?
Sure, Robin. But first of all, thanks for having me on. It's a pleasure to be on. Thanks for the invitation. So my story is I'm this mathematician and computer scientist that left his home country of Scotland to go and work and travel at the same time. And I started off life living in France and then transferred to the US. And as I've mentioned to you earlier, I've lived in the US now longer than I lived in my home country of Scotland. And my drive has always been focusing on how to help businesses and also people get the most out of technology. So in the early days, that was communication for me, right? So how do you bring mobile alive? So I'm one of the very early mobile people, as an example. I started off life when cell phones didn't exist. They were certainly not. So how do you build the infrastructure out to build that? So I've always been at the forefront of technology. Some call it the bleeding edge. And I love that excitement. I love being a pioneer of going where no one has gone before. That whole Star Trek theme, right? I'm old enough to remember the first episodes of Star Trek with William Shatner, right? As a kid watching this, and I always wanted to know. So the personal communicator, I had a dream at like 8 years old, like I want to have that personal communicator, and that stuck with me my whole life.
That's right. And you know what? Funny you mentioned that. I'm a technologist by background as well. I graduated from computer science a long time ago, before they changed computer science, I guess, nowadays. And I remember back in the days, although I don't do technology, like direct technology, like I'm not involved in building things, but I do it as a hobby. Like I still code and write my own programs just to see if I still have any skills in that domain. Of course, the languages have changed over the years. And of course, I did the telecom round as well back in the Bell days when I worked for a small telecom company in one of the provinces in Canada. It's called NBTEL, but I'm not sure if you're familiar with the Canadian geography, no. But that's a province on the East Coast called New Brunswick.
New Brunswick. Yeah. New Brunswick. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's where I lived most of my adult life. And I moved to Toronto a few years back. And so yeah, and now I go into services, and I went into business development and growing companies, etc. But part of me still have that nostalgia back into technology, building things or assisting people in building things. It just that gives you that drive of discovery. I see where you're coming from.
No more excitement than sitting next to somebody on a plane and they're using products that I've either helped design, build, or bring to market. And I talk to people. Right. And the key thing to learn when you're building technology is talk to the people who are going to be using it. Understand what they're going to be doing. Right. That's We have that concept at Iridius when we call it where we co-design our products with initially with our customers, because we can design the best product out there, but we're not arrogant enough to say like, well, this is how thou shalt use the product, right? And this is, that's why products break, because customers don't use the product the way you intended it in your mind. You've got to learn. Always be curious in learning what your customers are wanting and really stand yourself out from the competition. What differentiates yourself? And having those understanding of your customer, I call it a 360-degree view of your customer. I'm a sci-fi fan, right? I hinted that that was Star Trek. All a lifelong sci-fi novel fan. And one of the earliest novels I read was A Stranger in a Strange Land by Robert Heinlein, which was, and he brought out this concept of grokking. Okay. Now, you may have heard that term, but when I bring that up with some people, go, what does that mean? What is that word? And I explain it. And the explanation of grok is that where the aliens merged with the humans so they could understand and get that 360 degree view of what's going on, attachment to that to the human. It's the same thing with your customers. You've got to grok your customer. What motivates them? Why do they want to do something? If you're going to change buyer behavior, think again, because that's one of the hardest things to do. Behavioral change is hard. And so you want to bring, one of the things that I stress in every product that I work on is how do you bring a taste of the familiar into what they're doing? We got, oh, yeah, yeah, now I get it. And so this isn't scary. And so you'd walk them in slowly but surely into, okay, this is the power of the tool rather than overwhelming them with whatever it is you're building. It could be hardware, it could be software, it could be a combination of both.
Absolutely. And Philip, you bring up a very good point, which I'd like to drill down a little bit on, is that the understanding of the customer when developing a product or services. You know, there is a lot of companies, they do market research, they do customer research, they survey, they do a bunch of things. But you took it a step further. You said, I'm going to talk to these customers, right? So you want to sit down and you enjoy, you know, when you see somebody using your product and services on a plane or in a mall or however, you enjoy seeing them using it. And then you probably approach them, say, hey, you're using my product. What do you think of it? That's business to consumer. So business to business, what is the advice there? How do you do business to business understanding, I guess.
So the first thing you've got to do, because you're dealing with you're still dealing with people in B2B. So the question is, what size of business are you going after? Are you going after enterprise? Are you going after mid-market? Or are you going after small business? There are benefits and cons to each one of those sectors. So let's unpack that a little bit. So at Iridius, we're exclusively focused on enterprise right now. The great thing that comes with enterprise is that they're big customers, which means the deals are big. And when you land them, they're typically very sticky because unless you really mess up, you've got that customer pretty much for life unless things change. So then it's about landing that initial beachhead and then developing that account where you start getting the expansion of your products and services throughout the account. Those are two different kinds of people. So you've got a hunter who has to go hunting for the opportunities. And then you've got the farmer who is nurturing the account so you can get the expansion, get into the next opportunity, and really ensure that you're not churning the customer. When you go into the problem is with the cons and all of that is it takes a long, long, long time to get that deal done. And for a startup, time is your enemy. Time is your enemy for most companies, but especially for a startup, because you don't have revenue coming in the door. You've got a finite runway.
Yeah, short cash runway, right?
Is exactly right. How do you augment that? How do you make it work? So there are tricks that you do to make that. So how do you get into an enterprise faster? There are ways that you can do that. Getting introduced. A hot introduction at the right level is key. If you are not dealing with people at the enterprise who are in the C-suite or own the budgets, you have a long, friction-filled road to revenue. Because now you've got your building up your coalition of support, which are the directors, the managers, the VPs. And then they've got to build the story up to their C-suite. And what do they know? I mean, you talk to CFO at a large pharma. They don't know who you are. And they just go like, how long has this company been in business? What are the risks in this? Why would I take a risk in this? So you've got all of this work you have to do to ensure you land these customers. So the way you get to those customers is through your network. Using LinkedIn is great, and people at lower levels will eventually respond to you. But the C-suite's not going to give a darn, right? They don't care. So you need somebody the C-suite knows to say, you need to meet Iridius, and here's why. And because they have that consultative relationship, not consulting, consultative relationship with that C-suite. It's like, okay, I'll take a look at this company, right? And they do. And then it's up to you to, now that you've had that introduction, that you earn their trust. The thing in B2B, that there's one word that sums it all up, it is trust, even in small business.
100%.
And then when you go to mid-market, it's not that difficult. It's still challenging, but it's not as difficult as enterprise. So a lot of startups, what they do is like, okay, we know we're going enterprise, but we're going to fill the coffers up with SMBs. But the problem when you do that is that you're missing your ICP, your ideal customer profile, because you've built your product, you've built your marketing engine, you've built your whole go-to-market strategy towards that ICP. And the ICP in a mid-market company is different. And it's a different beast altogether. Yes, you'll get you're getting the revenue in the door, perfect. But you're still missing, if you've said to your VCs, your investors, we're going after enterprise, and what they see for the first 2 years are 90%, you know, mid-market businesses and, you know, a couple of percent enterprise. That's nice to them, but it doesn't nail the story home that they go like, well, I invested in this enterprise-grade company. So it takes discipline and it takes relationships to break or hack your way through to the decision process. And that's what we do. I mean, what the value that Iridius brings is we have the ability with our age, because we are all experienced. We have all had decades of experience. We're not your typical startup with younger generation. We have a lot of younger people working with us, don't get me wrong, but we have the relationships at the most senior levels at Microsoft as an example. And it's those people it's not the account teams, it's those people who are bringing us into the accounts. And that's how we're hacking it, because of our relationships with Microsoft. I'm ex-Microsoft, so these people I've worked with for a long, long time and built a lot of trust up with the years. And again, it goes back to trust.
Absolutely. Selling to the C-suite, that's what got me here from the beginning. So I love that model that you're promoting, Philip. I love the way that you're going after it. And there was always a saying that says, you know, any typical selling model that says it doesn't matter who you're selling to, you gotta sell to the top of the organization. If it's a small, medium, big, I don't care. You gotta sell to the top of the organization. And somebody says, well, they didn't answer me. Well, then you're not right. Really, maybe the target is not yours, or you don't have the right relationship, so you haven't found the right way to do it. And it sounds like you're practicing, you know, the Miller-Hyman.
God, now you're bringing up old memories. You're absolutely right.
I'm not supposed to do that, right? Okay.
You remember the golden silence? I practiced the golden silence. That was one of the earliest tricks that I've learned. That it works every single time. There's a funny story in here with the golden silence, Miller-Hyman, the golden silence. Was I practiced it my whole sales career, from days when I was starting to carry a bag, being an individual contributor, all the way through, you know, through executive management. And we just sit back and you don't say anything. That's what the golden silence is, because nobody likes a silence, and you wait for the customer to talk. That worked every single time except once. And this is the funny story. So if I used to own Nokia, I used to run wireless at Texas Instruments, and Nokia was our number one account. And we were doing a big negotiation, and I was there for the final negotiation. And we sat around that table for 15 minutes with nobody saying a darn thing. And I said, okay, guys, you're playing the game right back at me. Okay, what do you really want?
Everybody knows the trick, do they? Everybody knows the golden silence.
In Finland, they do. I'll tell you, in Finland, they absolutely did. But as everybody laughed at the end, even the Finns laughed. They said, because they knew the trick I was playing. I mean, it's like,
man, you bring up a very good strategic selling. Millerheim and all these guys, they pretty much tell you to sell high as you can, and yeah, see where you end up. You made a very good point that friction selling from the ground up, from the lower level all the way to the top, it's a long, slugging, you know, road filled with a lot of misery sometimes.
Yeah.
Budget is not approved, and, you know, you're not controlling the communication, and, you know, somebody else is controlling your destiny in that sales process. But you seem to have Absolutely. Cut to the chase, go to the top, have the conversation, and see where it goes.
And it's all about altitude. We talk about selling at altitude, right? Because it's not always the CEO, right? Of course, the CEO is obviously always the ultimate decision maker and everything. But, you know, you've got to understand who your buyers are, right? Mm-hmm. Who can sign the check? And if you're not talking to the person who can sign the check, you need to figure out a way how to get to that person. Now, in a mid-sized business, that typically is the CEO, and you go straight to that person, then that person will typically talk to you. When you're dealing with an enterprise with 77,000 employees globally, you're not going to get to that CEO no matter how hard you try.
True.
And, you know, so it's the only way to get to that CEO is through their board, and typically, or a relationship. So
yeah, that's right. Now, let's get to know a little bit about Iridius. What does Iridius do? Sure. Tell us a little bit about the company.
So we started the company in July 2024. Four of us co-founded the company, immediately expanded to, you know, to 11 and 12 people. We're now at 12 people. We are focused on solving two problems for enterprises. So we, first of all, our focus is trusted enterprise AI at scale for highly regulated industries. And the initial industries that we're focused in on are pharma and manufacturing. We do work in FSI, financial services and insurance, healthcare life sciences. But our primary focus is pharma and manufacturing. And when you look at that and you go like, oh God, why are you doing that? That's got to be the hardest ones to go after, because those companies are built like the government, and they're not built for change. And when it comes to AI, they're struggling, and you've seen all the stats on that. What we solve are two problems for enterprises. The first is safe and responsible AI. So we adhere to what are called the FATE principles, which is fairness, accountability, transparency, and explainability. So we provide a platform that at design time designs your solution. I'm not talking about an application. I'm talking about a real solution. So complex workflows. And we take artifacts, could be literally a napkin drawing, a PRD, a product requirements document, an MP4, the recording of a meeting, and literally any content. And we bring that in and we start to look at what is that application you're trying to build? And not only what are you trying to build, what industry you're in, and what compliance do you need, right? So there's compliance and there's governance. And so compliance, if you're dealing with globally, you've got things like the EU AI Act, you've got an untold number of ISO standards you've got to comply to. If you're in FSI, the chances are you're going to have some state and local in the US issues that you have to deal with. And then you've got your own corporate governance. How does it behave within your corporate governance? Because the thing with AI is, like, I'll ask the question of your audience, would you let your hundreds or thousands or even millions of interns loose in your company systems without any training? You go, that would be the dumbest idea on the planet. And we would agree with you on that. That's the thing, that's the reason why. Think of these agents as these interns. You've got to train them. You've got to not only train them on how they have to comply to standards and regulations, but also how they comply within your corporate governance, state of conduct, all of the things, just like you would with an employee. So what we do is that we provide a multi-agent system and a framework that once we've taken the context, what you've done, and we build out the architecture And all the other artifacts that you need, like executive summaries and everything else on there, and get you through the process and generate the code. And when we generate the code, this is not what's called vibe coding that you get with all these other tools that are out there. Generate production ready code. The only thing that we do not do is the functional testing. We go through all the way through user acceptance testing. And that process normally takes companies months, sometimes well over a year. We do it in days. And honestly, we do it in hours, right? But we say days because that's more realistic, but it's literally hours we can do it in. And what that gives our enterprise, the ability to know that whatever they're designing right now would be approved by their legal team, their risk team, you know, the marketing team, everybody, so that we can get that everybody to say yes and getting into production and start generating revenue. We have seen all kinds of statistics out there recently, like the MIT report, where 95% of generative AI projects, you know, never get out of pilot, right, or don't have any realization of revenue. And there are multiple reasons for that to happen, but the biggest one is risk. And that's risk of fines, that's risk of causing harm, right, in manufacturing. People die on factory floors, right? It's an inherently dangerous environment. Mm-hmm. How do you prevent that? And how do you get, not only gain operational efficiencies, but how do you drive outcomes? And the other component of AI that people know, in the most part, but I will reiterate, is that when you're talking about end B2B applications, people need determinism. They need to know that it's going to do A, B, C, D, E, whatever that is, time and time again. That causes rigidity and brittleness in those systems. That means that they're not very flexible. So there's no ability as things change. So a lot of these applications don't get used as much as they should do. How do you then bring that value and drive those outcomes? And that's what we do. We deliver outcomes for each of our customers.
So a few things. One is, so I understand and the audience is clear on this, it's an application or an agent development platform for regulated business. Did I get
it's
that
more
right?
More than that, it's actually, we call it a solution factory, right? So when you look, your audience may be familiar with tools like Cursor, Replit, LangChain, the list goes on, right? So many of those out there. That is not us. We, in fact, can use any one of those tools, or you don't need to use them because we do it. Because the key thing with AI is to give it context. And the more context you give it, the more accurate it is. So AI is probabilistic, right? It's not deterministic. So for an enterprise, you need to bring that determinism in there. And we've figured that out, how to do that. So we bring determinism into a system that's inherently probabilistic. And you get all the benefits of the flexibility, the resilience that agentic systems can actually bring to a system that they can learn, that they can adapt. And you're giving them not only the guardrails, mm-hmm. but the entitlements as to what they are allowed to do. So if the CEO is asking something, clearly their agents are the ability to do pretty much anything, right? In theory. Whereas if you talk to an analyst, that their agents will only be able to see what they have the purview to look at. And that's the important thing. And the other thing that we do is scalability. People are talking today about agents about being these big monolithic blocks of code still, which is the old way of programming.
Right, that's right.
For us, an agent could be a single line of code, right? For us, an agent could be data. An agent could be a human. An agent can literally be anything. And the thing that that agent does is it does that one thing really, really well. So if you think in the context of, let's say you own a vehicle, and most of your audience, I'm sure, own vehicles, and you don't know that your battery is going to die until you get out that morning and go, click, click, sure. What the heck, right? Now, imagine now that vehicle could, in advance, through error detection codes, be able to now notify you as the driver, saying, hey, your battery's starting to run low. You've probably got about 2 weeks left. You could get an appointment down at this when you're driving by. Set it up. Do you want me to make the appointment for you, right? What does that solve? Well, it's not a gimmick, because these auto manufacturers, who work with several, they're called walk homes. And that's a huge customer satisfaction issue for them. If they're literally, if their vehicle breaks down, they have to walk home. They maybe get a loaner, of course, nowadays, but you know what I'm saying. That's what they call it. So
it'll take an Uber home.
That's it. But there are all kinds of benefits you can give. You know, and what else? Where else could they be using AI? Well, they can be using AI clearly in manufacturing itself, right? So everybody talks about predictive maintenance being the hottest. That's a problem that's really well solved today. The real problem that has not been solved, which is one that we are solving, that we have found, is that all of these large enterprises think they're unique. Mm-hmm. And in their own way, they are. Mm-hmm. But we are working with literally tens of global pharmas and manufacturers out there. And every single one of these customers that we are talking to, and I'm in every single one of these conversations, 98% of the patents are identical, literally that high. It's incredibly high.
I didn't think it would be that high.
The reason why it's that high, maybe I'm exaggerating a little bit. Maybe it's like 80. So it's in that 80 to 90 plus range.
But still high. I mean, I would have thought, 20 would be high.
The reason why it's so high is they follow these things called good practices. And these are standards that were developed back in the 80s. And that's what they're still working to. Mm-hmm. That's the commonality right there.
That's right. Phil, I work in something called the language industry, and mm-hmm. I'm not sure if it's on your radar, but the language industry, it's about $60 billion industry formed of about 90.
I have to tell you another funny story there. My wife and I had a language services company a couple of years ago. So
no way, really? Well, we've got to talk about that. No, just kidding. Maybe for another conversation, but we'll talk about it. Now, where does something like this fit in solving, let's say, the language issue for those large organizations? I'm assuming pharma companies that you work with, large companies that you're working with, they all at the same time have a commercialization issue with their products, right? So how do you commercialize that product globally after you've manufactured it? Do you get involved at that stage?
We typically do not because we're not a model company. We're not a large language company. We are an AI company. So we're not in Gen AI. We are a true AI company. So when it comes to those LLMs, you have to work with companies like Microsoft with their cognitive services. Mm-hmm. They're supporting, I don't know. The last time I looked, it was well in excess of 200 languages that they were using that had, they're, as you know, from coming from the language services industry, there's translation, which is the written word, and then there's interpretation, which is the spoken word. And which one do you want to do?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
And with interpretation and real-time interpretation, you're not quite getting the accuracy that you need of having a human interpreter in the loop there, right? You need to get over 80% accuracy. The last time I looked, which was a year ago, and I'm sure this is a lot better, they were getting, with languages like Spanish, yes, they were getting, because of the popularity, getting the accuracy. But when you're looking at languages that were less spoken, surprisingly, Russian was down to like at 62% accuracy. And, mm-hmm. It was not good. So it's not understandable. Technology will catch up. I believe that the language services industry is definitely ripe for disruption. Mm-hmm. You're seeing companies getting out of translation now because that is something that you can use AI. That the written word, that works.
I did a podcast three podcasts ago with Veronica Hilak. We discussed the idea that Silicon Valley is promoting that the title was we've solved the language problem, technology did. And it does sound pretty ambitious from a title perspective because us professionals who worked most of their lives in the industry haven't seen that yet. I mean, I agree with the percentage of solution. You've solved 50%. In some cases, you didn't solve even 20%. Depends on the minority of the language. If the language is only spoken by a handful of people around the world, you haven't solved anything, zero probably. And that's why the reason I'm asking is, the question is, Silicon Valley says we've solved the language problem. And it sounds from your perspective, we have ways to go a little bit.
I believe we do. I mean, it won't be long, but I'm thinking that in the next 1 to 2 years, it will be a solved problem. I think it will be that quick, personally.
Sure. Sure.
There's a lot of government push, various governments push. So, for example, there's a lot of coverage for languages, for Western and some Eastern languages, right? But when you get to African languages, which is people are definitely not getting access to the technology in Africa that they could and should do as a result of that.
True. Right? Sub-Saharan languages is very underrepresented in the data from a learning data. Data training for AI is underrepresented. Indic languages get a little bit of a limited amount of data for training. And you're right. I mean, the world is focused now on the FIGs. We call them the French, English, Italian, German, Spanish, and a few Asian languages. But we don't have a lot of focus on the less spoken languages. And what's driving it, in my opinion, is commerce. You know, if you're the volume of the commerce is happening in one language, it drives those solutions because that's, you know, dollars and cents at the end of the day that's driving these things.
So back to Iridius, because we were talking about the LSP industry. For when we were language service providers for your audience, but I'm sure they know that. But going back to Iridius, we don't care what language is in. So we actually, for one of our clients, actually built out a multilingual customer support application for them. And it handled all. But we didn't do the translation or the interpretation. That was done through Microsoft Cognitive Services, right? So we were doing the calls out to that. But we were able to really show that in real time. And we tested it with anger, happiness, and all kinds of emotional reaction. And it worked really, really well. And it was 100% AI driven. It was the, and we're seeing in customer support that this is where really where AI is coming to a level of maturity. You've seen companies like Salesforce announcing 4,000 people from their support staff being laid off. They're still going to need some level of humans in there. They believe they had 100 million missed calls over a period of I think 4 or 5 years or something like that, and they're going to get to 100% calls answered immediately. Mm-hmm. That's their plan. Now, it may be a pipe dream, I don't know, but they certainly went very public about it, last weekend. And the we're seeing that across the board, across enterprises, that customer support is really being targeted by AI.
Yeah. Now, one of the things, from an Iridius point of view, and you work in the regulated industry, which I've been working with the regulated industry for the most part of my life, is security and data jurisdiction.
Yep.
Now, can you give us a little bit of a guidance on how does Iridius deal with data jurisdiction and security?
Oh, great question. Security and privacy are all built right in. How we handle security is that we have the Iridius Solution Factory is both at design and also runtime. This is the important part. So at runtime, think of us like Windows Defender. We have the team that's protecting you as your AI solution is in operation. So this goes to compliance, because these regulations are changing in real time, almost in real time. So we stay ahead of the curve in that. We keep our customers, just like you would keep our customers safe, just like we would with Microsoft Defender, with Windows Defender. You know, you've got banks of people at Microsoft who do nothing but look at malware and attack vectors and everything else. We do that for the compliance side. We also do it for the security side. Inherently built into the runtime of our system are several things. The first one is that we operate in a zero trust model, which means that we treat each agent as hostile. So everything works with least privilege. So you have the assurances that if the bad people are in, they can't do anything silly with the tools, because they have to go through the platform they're using. That could be Microsoft's Azure platform, AWS, or GCP, Google's cloud platform. You know, we use the tools that they have to prevent that, because they're very, very secure in that regard. So we built our systems around their security features, and we literally protect each agent from attack. It's never 100%. But with zero trust and entitlements, that's the permissions, what they're entitled to do, you get extremely far down the road when it comes to building a secure system. Now, when it comes to privacy and your data, we not only do your traditional data at rest, data in motion, but we also encrypt at compute time for the really secure stuff. So we are minimizing exposure. You talked about data sovereignty. We don't care where the data is. You decide, you know, you've already decided what your jurisdiction is. So we just operate under that jurisdiction. It's literally that simple for us, right? It's just, Well, is it just Europe? Okay, it's just Europe. Is it the US? Okay, it's just the US. So, you know, do I want my data in Gibraltar or do I want it in Estonia? Or do I want it, you know, you have complete utter flexibility in where that is to meet your needs. And we don't touch that system. You've set your own tenant up on Azure or AWS or GCP. You've already set all of that up and we just follow those rules.
Okay. Now, the only reason I ask about data sovereignty is because it's a discussion that's happening here in Canada where I'm located quite often. And when it comes to artificial intelligence, the country not yet have their own data centers where the data is resident in Canada. Meanwhile, it's a requirement by policy from the regulated industry that the data be in Canada, residing in Canada. And they have something called, I'm not sure if you're familiar with, data in transit and data at rest in Canada.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about. So when I was talking about the right beginning, so data at rest, you know, we have encryption. Data in motion, we have encryption, right? So we use TLS 1.3, and if they come out TLS 1.4 or 2.0, we use that. But the important one, those are important, but the really critical one that most companies miss, and we have not missed, is encryption at compute time. So polymorphic encryption, we do that. We handle that. So you've got a third layer of encryption with us. Actually, when your data is actually in operation and being used, it's encrypted.
Now, if I was interested in doing business with Iridius and I'm contemplating what kind of ROI, how do I, you know, approach you guys? So just from an ROI perspective, can you give an example to, let's say, somebody who's interested in doing business with you? You're trying to build the case for them that, look, it's costing you X now. You use Iridius, it's going to cost you Y. How's that going to work for you?
Two things to unpack there. So the first one is identifying just as you said, what is the pain point you're trying to solve? So when you look at pharma for us, the first complex workflow that we went into was what's called GXP validation, which is how do you validate the whole process from start to finish to the point where, you know, of manufacturing the drug, whatever the drug is, whatever the biological is. And we companies in pharma are literally spending on their own billions of dollars for that compliance. If you talk to a global pharma that is truly global and has got multi-billion dollars of sales for that drug, they're probably spending $1 billion to $1.5 billion a year and hundreds of people to do this because it's all manual. It's going back to 1988 workflows. They're literally taking with their phones a screenshot and then uploading that image into the reporting tool. I mean, it is a horrible process, fraught with potential errors.
Of course. And security flaws.
And security flaws, it's just like all the rest. So we eliminate all of that for them so we can automate a significant portion of that. You still have, the key is still to have humans in the loop. There's no replacing on that. But all of these repeatable tasks can be fully automated and deterministically, you know, so as well, right? And so that's one part of the ROI. The second part of the ROI is that built into our tool is actually ROI calculations. So we actually, from throughout the whole process, give you ROI calculations. Because when you talk to a CIO and they go like, well, what is my ROI on this? You need to be able to prove it. And it's, you know, the tool, platforms like ours that do that. I mean, they're in operation. So not only is your CFO not going to get a surprise, what is this $60,000 bill I just got from Microsoft?
Yep.
Come running down the corridor. And by the way, that happens on a regular basis. because people are not managing as closely as they should. What is it going to cost to actually operate the system? There's one thing, okay, I've got this $1 billion problem over here, and I've got this solution here that will cost me $80 million or whatever the number is to run. I'm making that number up, by the way. That's not a real number. They see the ROI on that and go, okay, I've got my 10x return. Bingo, I'm going to go and do that. Now prove it to me, right? So part of the thing when you go into an enterprise sale is they want a pilot or a proof of concept or a proof of value, right? So you've got to prove that from the get-go, because if you're not meeting those metrics, it's not going to happen. So that's how we prove ROI. It's a multi-stage effect.
And so I don't know if you do any work, let's say in Canada, for instance, or do you have like certain geography that you're more strong in than others? Is there any preference as to where the
we are global? We are primarily focused on North America, including Canada. So we are already talking to Canadian companies, and we are also talking to many companies in Europe. And so our focus right now is there, but we are talking to a very large financial institution in India. So we're global. We are already global. We're going where the opportunities are for our solution.
Okay. And so for that matter, anything else that a global customer who is interested in reaching out to you, they should keep in mind or they should know?
What they should keep in mind is rip out what you thought you've learned for your entire career until now and start learning again. Now, what we have learned, and this is where us having grown up in the 80s in technology, believe it or not, a ton of what we learned in the 80s and the very early 90s, I'm talking like through 93, what we learned is hyper-relevant to what we are doing. Many AI enterprise AI companies don't have the expertise and are struggling. And we've gone like, we did that already. We did that already. And the good example is it's literally a 360. There's technologies out there that we don't use anymore, like compilers. We've effectively got a compiler.
That's right. That's right. Yeah.
It takes an idea. Now, it's not code that it compiles. It's a solution it builds, right? It's still a compiler. It's compiling all these artifacts together, coming back with your architecture and all the compliance you need, and boom, go run it.
Phil, just one last question here. I just to remember this question, I should have asked it earlier, is that one of the things that I hear quite a bit from enterprise, you know, you're talking to middle management or you're talking to somebody who says, you know, my boss told me to deploy AI. I said, what does that mean to you?
Exactly.
And nobody really can get a straight answer other than the boss is asking me to deploy it. And so the question is deploying something blindly versus methodically going after what business problem are we trying to solve and find a solution to it. Does Iridius play a role in that?
We absolutely do. So when we're talking to our customers, they often, and I do mean often, it's more often than not. I mean, I'm talking like in the calls that I'm in, what AI use case, it's definitely greater than 90%. This one I can be absolutely definite on. They're always asking, what AI use case should I go for, right? And so what we do is the work that they should have been doing, which is, well, I'm coming at it from the external. These companies are mostly publicly traded companies. So I've got all kinds of assets that I can go and search against. We go and reference all of their publicly traded available documents so we can see what I call migraine level pain points. Don't go after a pain point, go after a migraine. You go after a migraine, everybody knows I will pay anything to get rid of that migraine. And when you're talking about $1 billion problem for a single account, that's a migraine. That's money they could be spending in R&D.
Very painful, right? Migraine.
Yeah, exactly. And so go after the migraine. Don't go. Now, I understand you want to start small, but at least have a vision to get to the migraine.
Absolutely. Hey, Phil, I can talk to you forever. It sounds like to me, I love this conversation. It's very intriguing to me, and I'm sure to my audience, who always love to hear more about innovation and how are we addressing some of the current problems or some of the current business problems that we're trying to find solutions for. And Iridius seems to have hit the nail on the head with the approach here, going after the regulated business in a methodical way, in an approach where you've documented this, you've found solution for it, you're delivering it in a very secure and very thoughtful way to respect either the country you're working in or the policies of the company that you're working with in a way that it's returning good ROI for those CIOs that they have issues and migraine, as you mentioned, problems, as you mentioned earlier. So I want to thank you. Any last words, Philip, before we terminate the recording?
If people want to reach me, it's the easiest way to do it is just email me. And that's Philip with two L's, P-H-I-L-L-I-P, at Iridius, I-R-I-D-I-U-S.ai. And I will respond to you. That's the best way to read. Or on LinkedIn. My LinkedIn profile is Philip-Swan, S-W-A-N. So P-H-I-L-L-I-P-S-W-A-N on LinkedIn. That's how you reach me, and I will respond.
Absolutely. Thank you, Philip. Appreciate it.
And thank you.
I just want to let our audience know as well that Phil and I are connected on LinkedIn. If somebody from my connections who are interested in talking to Phil, please look him up. He's my first connection on LinkedIn, and you can find it pretty easy under my network. My network is open to everybody. Feel free to browse through. And if you need an introduction to Phil and you happen not to be connected to him directly, ask me for an introduction, and I would be happy to facilitate that.
My objective
here is to make sure that the network is connecting to the audience and to the guests, open connections to everybody. I want to thank you, Philip, for joining me today on this podcast recording, episode number 116. I want to encourage the audience to engage with this content, like, share, comment. And if you have any ideas for future episodes topics that you'd like us to address, please send me an email or contact me via LinkedIn. I'll be happy to address them. From Phil and myself, I want to thank you all, and until next time. Phil, hang on a second. Don't leave yet.